Hi, I'm Dr. Jared, and welcome to the Plantastic Podcast, a show for plant killers, green thumbs, and everyone else in between. Listen along as I deconstruct the craft and practices of remarkable horticulturists so that you can better cultivate your plants and yourself. Let's grow.
Hey, Plantastic peeps, it's Dr. Jared. Have you ever noticed how some plants grow together and love to mingle, while others insist on a little personal space? That pattern, whether a plant is a loner or a social butterfly, has a name. It's called plant sociability. And understanding it can help us design naturalistic plantings better, whether you're a gardener, a designer, or a landscape architect. I'm diving deep into plant sociability in my next Botanic Bootcamp session, Designing with Sociability, on Monday, November 10th at 6 p.m. Central. In this session, you'll learn how to read a plant's social tendencies, combine species that actually want to live together, and design plantings that look natural and stay manageable over time. I'll share practical frameworks and example plant lists, and of course, we'll finish with a Q&A to answer your questions. You can grab a discounted spot right now at meristemhorticulture.com/discount to save 20%, or you can use the link in your podcast app show notes. After November 10th, the price goes up, and spots are limited, so once they're gone, you'll have to catch the replay later. I hope you'll join us for this great session. This month, I recorded episode 47, and Molly Hendry returned to the Plantastic Podcast to share lessons and inspiration from attending the Bergamo Landscape Festival in Italy, a gathering that unites some of the world's most creative ecological designers. She was previously on episode 20, and I highly encourage you to go back and listen to that wonderful conversation. Molly toggles the worlds of design and plants as both a trained horticulturist and a landscape architect. She has stepped out to create her own garden design studio, Roots and Ramblings, where she does design work for folks in the Birmingham, Alabama area and beyond. With this studio, Molly is most interested in the intersection between people and places. She loves designing gardens for hands-in-the-dirt gardeners, focusing on how design is not just a master plan on a piece of paper, but an ongoing dialogue between a person and a place, often with a spade in hand. Up through July 2023, she was the Associate Director of Garden Support for the Friends of Birmingham Botanical Gardens for 5.5 years. There, she was actively involved in the horticultural and design development of 26 unique gardens that make up the Birmingham Botanical Gardens. And one of her top honors is that she spent 10 months living in the UK, sinking her hands into the soil at some of the top gardens across the country as the Garden Club of America's 2016-2017 Royal Horticultural Society's Interchange Fellow. In this episode, I get to live vicariously through Molly's time at the Landscape Festival. She reflects on a great workshop she did where they talked about redefining tree selection, succession, and long-term landscape care. Molly also discussed meeting her hero, Sarah Price, and her artful design at the Piazza this year. She discusses Tom Stewart Smith and Katie Barrington's designer-gardener collaboration presentation, and James Hitchmog's call to integrate management into design thinking, and so much more. We further discuss plant trials, adaptive maintenance, how design is a process and not a product. And Molly just distills so many ideas from this conference that reshape how we can approach gardening here at home. She also shares recent projects like her designs with the Charleston Park Conservancy and her new podcast, Garden Gab, which you got to take a listen to that. You can find links we discuss and access details from this conversation on the show notes at theplantasticpodcast.com. And you can learn more about Molly by visiting her website, Roots and Ramblings. That's RootsandRamblings.com. And you can also follow her on Instagram at Molls Hendry. That's MOLLSHENDRY. So without further ado, please enjoy this Plantastic conversation with Molly Hendry. Hi, Molly, and welcome back to the Plantastic Podcast. It's so good to talk to you today.
Thank you for having me back.
Yeah. So you're the first reoccurring guest on the Plantastic Podcast. Yeah. So what?
So honored.
Of course, normally I start off talking about where people's passion for plants germinated and mm-hmm. everything, et cetera. But I encourage listeners, go back and listen to episode 20, which was wonderful, with Molly talking about how we tell stories with gardens. But today I've invited her on the podcast because she recently had the opportunity to go visit and attend the Bergamo Landscape Festival. And mm-hmm. so, Molly, can you just start off telling people about what Bergamo is and how you were able to go this year?
Yes. I told Jared, anytime I'm able to relive this week of my life, I will gladly accept the invitation. So the International Landscape Festival, I believe it began about 15 years ago, and it's in this amazing village about an hour east of Milan. And it runs for the whole month, but it culminates in this meeting in the middle of September, and practitioners from all over the world descend on this adorable medieval village called Bergamo. And the city of Bergamo is actually quite big. I thought you just would arrive at the train station, you were in the village, but you arrive at kind of this bigger city center where a lot of people, I believe, live in Bergamo and take the train into Milan for work. So it's actually quite a big suburb of Milan, but at the top of I had to take a taxi all the way up this mountain, and you get to the old walled medieval village on top of the mountain, and it's just cobblestone streets and just very charming, all these interconnected piazzas, incredible restaurants. And so there's just, you arrive and you're, okay, this is going to be a fantastic week just because of the setting. And then I actually had the opportunity to go last year as well. A lot of my British gardening friends attend every year, and I've always watched it from afar. And my friend Annie Guilfoyle is on kind of the board for the conference, where she's one of the voices that's helping determine who will be speakers and different things like that. So she's always been like, Molls, you got to come. So last year I thought, okay, this is my year. And I went thinking it would just be this fun one-time adventure. And then once I got there and started meeting all the people and hearing the speakers, and I thought to myself, oh no, this is going to be really hard to ever miss ever again. So I made a pact to myself, if I could find ways of getting the flight for free, it's actually pretty much the same price or less expensive than going to a lot of the conferences that you would go to as a practitioner in the US. And so it's an amazing week. And Annie runs the Garden Masterclass with Noel Kingsbury. So they always do a workshop on the Wednesday. That's like an all-day workshop. And I think we're going to talk about that. But then on Thursday is another all-day seminar. That one has different themes to it. And then Friday and Saturday are the international meeting. And that has a lineup of speakers. Each speaker speaks for about 40 to 45 minutes. And you are just taken on this whirlwind garden adventure. I spent the whole 9-hour flight on the way home just pouring through my notes, because it felt like so much amazing content to just marinate in.
Yeah. Definitely. Now, I've listened to your episode on Garden Gab, where you and Tessa, of course, recounted your wonderful trip. And so I was able to glean a few things from that. So let's go ahead and start with the workshop that you attended on Wednesday that was hosted by Garden Masterclass. From what I understand, that was focused on more tree selection for spaces. One of the things that I thought was so interesting from the conversation you had on the podcast was that oftentimes we pick a species, a tree, based on like color or size, but y'all were discussing there's this also whole thinking process about the successional stage that tree is in. So can you talk more about that? And then, of course, if there's anything else that pops up that you thought was valuable from that session, please share it. Love to learn.
Absolutely. Yeah, this was one of the sessions where I signed up because I love Annie, and the title of it was, I think, Choosing Trees for a Changing Climate. And I thought, that's interesting. And I've already come all the way from Italy, but there was other things that I was really geared up for that I was really excited about. And I was blown away by this workshop. It has been one of the things that I've been left just rolling around in my mind with, just thinking about everything. But it's, first of all, the setting. You go back down into the valley. You take a bus from City Alta, which is the old medieval town at the top of the mountain, take a bus down to this medieval monastery that's in the valley. So already you're set up to just have a lovely day. And so Henrik, and both of us have tried to say his last name. I'm not going to attempt to say it, but it's lovely and it's Swedish. And he's one of those amazing practitioners that I think lives three people's lives, but in one body. And so he's a professor at university, but is doing his own research and his own, I think he has his own studio where he's doing things. So he's just really coming at trees from a lot of different angles. And I just really appreciated the whole, he wasn't just coming at it from one point of view. And so during, he had this beautiful presentation that I think he also, he read a book with Aaron Anderson called, I just read what this was. It's called The Essential Tree Selection Guide. And he and Aaron walk through how a lot of times we are choosing trees solely based on aesthetics, like how tall does it get? What's its flower color? If it has a flower, fall color, the texture of the leaf, all those fun little designery things that we like to obsess over, which they're not saying that those things are not important. But he had, during this presentation, he had this amazing graph about all the things that make a tree successful. And the last thing on the list was aesthetics, because his point was, if you have a dead tree or a struggling tree, it doesn't matter, you know, what its fall color is, because it's dead. So I just thought that was such a great point and really challenged me as a designer also to think through what trees can offer to a landscape besides just their beauty, which I think beauty is so important. That's not to discount that, but there's other things that trees offer and create spatially, and ecological services that they offer, carbon they sequester, shade that they cast, wind that they can break, habitat that they can form for different species. And so there's just a lot to think through with trees. And this was an overarching theme that I walked away from the conference with, but it really started this day at this tree workshop, was engaging with creating places as a process instead of just this product that you produce. Mm-hmm. And the nature of being a designer is at the end of the day, you're handing over drawings that are done in CAD and are very exact with lovely line weights and an exact middle point where you put the exact species of shrub with plant schedules and things. And I'm not saying that we don't need to do those things, but that's not the ending point. That's a starting point. That's setting something into motion. And so one of the things that Henrik talked about was succession. And I would love to hear your thoughts on this too, Jared, as we're both living and working in the southeastern U.S. And there's just ways that things happen traditionally, whether it's residential design or in public spaces, where it doesn't really lend itself to you having a relationship with that place over a long period of time. But if we're to really create landscapes that are going to be successful and be able to withstand a changing climate, we need to be able to engage with those changes that we don't exactly know are coming. And especially with trees, you're planting a tree that's going to be there for decades and decades. And we can't foresee into the future every challenge that's going to arise, because there's diseases that moved in, there's changing temperatures, storms that are coming that you can't foresee, just a whole host of environmental factors that are always in flux. He talked about how we need to understand the current environment that tree is going to be going into, but also what that environment is on trajectory towards, if that makes sense, but then the successional process. And I just thought that was really thought-provoking as a designer, because you're normally just thinking, what can I find in a nursery? Will it be blocking a window outside this person's house? You're just thinking about very functional things, which are important. This really zoomed me out as a designer to a macro scale of how does this tree fit within a much larger fabric?
Yeah, because if you read Garden Revolution, one of the things they talk about in that book is that oftentimes in gardens, what we're creating is essentially steady states, is how they phrased it. Because if you think about succession, let's say you start with bare soil, and Mother Earth hates bare soil. So soon you're going to start to have some root rolls germinate, maybe a few scraggly briars or vines, and then you're going to start having your early shrubs or maybe pioneer species. And then shortly after that, you're going to get into your bigger trees, and then eventually, finally, your like climax species.
Yes.
And so one of the things we're doing as gardeners is we're actually keeping the landscape in a steady state, where we are going in and we are removing those saplings. We are making sure that we don't have new species germinate. And if we put trees into the landscape, we're basically creating a point in time where that species would naturally fall along that succession. I don't know about you in Alabama, but if we have saplings and stuff start to come up here, usually they're like sweet gums. That's one of the first kind of saplings type things that we have. Red buds, a few maples here and there as well too. But if you go in and you put an oak into a landscape, that's a species that typically you might not see until later on in that sort of successional journey. And I thought too, it was interesting in the book because they talked about how there's some landscapes where like they have dense shrubs where because of the fact that they've been managed so well, that you've got that ground cover layer and you've got that shrub layer there, that really don't get any new emergence of that climax community. So it's become that stable state there. So I wholeheartedly agree with you. I think that too often we just put a tree in, not thinking about where it is at in that successional stage. But maybe that's something we should consider more. Maybe we need to go in with something like a few red buds and then tuck in some smaller oaks or maples in anticipation that in 30 years, those red buds might start being declining. But yet the oaks and other things, they would be coming along.
They were protected under the shade of that red bud. So you're almost engaging, you're allowing the design process to work within the natural flow that sites already wanting
to
be moving in. And Henrik, he actually talked about this public project that he did in Stockholm, and the design team said, okay, we're going to plant out, you know, there's early, mid, and late succession trees. And so they planted out a whole host of trees that were within each of those windows of succession. And they said, we're going to plant it really heavily, knowing that we're going to need to come back in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and make edits. But it's going to allow this to be a much more successful plant community down the road. And so they actually held back 20% of the budget that was to be held for 20 years that allowed them to come back. And I think about that because in Birmingham, we had this amazing project called City Walk that covers 10 blocks in downtown Birmingham. And it's actually under our huge expressway where a ton of different interstates exchange right in the heart of downtown Birmingham. And it was just dead space under there. And the city used some funds that came available to put this park in. And I was actually working at the Botanical Gardens at the time. And I hadn't heard any of these talks or anything. I hadn't been around people that were using this kind of language. But just in my gardening experience, I knew there's going to be things that go in the ground, but there's no way to know how it's going to change or react. And so I was actually called by the landscape architects that were out of Atlanta, and they said, we'd love for you to look at the plant list as just an objective party and let us know if there's anything that like glaringly looks like it won't work. And I reviewed the plant list and I told them, y'all have done your homework. There's nothing here that I think is wrong or won't do, but there's going to be things that y'all can't account for. And I asked them, is there any way you can hold back part of the budget and have a posture where you're able to observe? I was like, there's going to be things that really surprise you, but this is such a human created environment. There's no way to exactly know what's going to happen. I think there's going to be ones that surprise you. There's going to be ones that you think are going to do great that are going to fail. And they were like, that's cute. Nope, we have to use the whole budget. Thanks for your input. I never heard from them again. And now the project is being bounced around all these different entities within the city. No one wants to take ownership over it because no one wants to have the management fall under them. Mm. And it's this huge issue because they created this incredible park and no one knows how to manage it, or there's not funds to manage it. And I just think there's a total disservice, and it could be touted. It's this huge media. You're able to say, look what we did. And it's all big and flashy when it opens. But then you've got to be thinking 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line. And I think that's what's missing a lot of times. I think that happens on a residential scale as well, because installers, they can do exactly what was on the plan that the designer gave them. And then it goes in the ground, it looks great, they get their check and they leave, and it's not their problem when 5, 10, 15 years down the road, things are failing. And as a designer, I get called in a lot And there's a lot of finger pointing that happens, I find, with homeowners, which is reasonable because a lot of times they've paid a lot of money and they're like, I didn't know to be asking these questions. And why would they put that plant here if it needs shade and it's in blazing sun and now it's dying and I've paid all this money for it? And I just think I think we need more collaborations between all the different, between municipalities, between designers and contractors and people who are maintaining these places. I think there can be just a siloing of information, and you know how to get in and do your job and get your check for what you do. And it actually sets it up to not be as successful down the road. And it has really challenged me as a designer to seek out contractors that are going to be willing to be a collaborator instead of just doing exactly what was drawn in CAD. I think it just makes a much better product and is actually a much better service to whoever your client is.
Yeah. Is there anything else from the workshop that you wanted to hit on?
I was just thinking about, because I actually bought Henrik's book. I didn't know that he was the one that was doing this workshop. And I bought it when I was doing a project in Charleston, South Carolina, and I was needing to really study up on plants that could withstand saltwater flooding. And I was really coming up short with all of my normal resources. There's just no talk of salt, or if there is, it's salt spray and not saltwater inundation, which is a completely different thing to a plant. And so I found this book, and in the back, it has this incredible, I actually have it in front of me here. It has this incredible chart for each of the species and the things that they're telling you about each species. So let's just take pecan is back here, and its height is extra large, its growth habit, its growth rate, it has broadleaf or evergreen, how much shade it provides, its wind regulation, its drought tolerance, flood tolerance, wind tolerance, shade tolerance, and then it has salt tolerance. And under salt tolerance, it has high, medium, low, whether it's windborne, ground presence, or windborne and ground presence. And then it has other notes. And so you're able to look at this and see exactly where the successional flow it is. And you're able to take into account so many more things about that species than just its fall color. And to compare it, I took out our Bible in the South for trees and woody material is Durr's Manual, which has served me so well ever since. I think this is still mine that I bought back in 2010 as a little baby horticulture student. But I just flipped it open and was looking at oaks, and it has how long the leaves are, what the buds look like, the size it'll get, the hardiness zone, its habit, how you propagate it, because Michael Durr was a nurseryman and is always thinking about how you grow something, which is important for these things to be a viable thing to have in the trade. And a lot of times he tells you like where he's seen it out in the wild. But then for native habitat, he just lists Vermont, southern Maine to Virginia, west to Minnesota, Nebraska, yeah, Texas, and Mexico. And that doesn't really tell me anything about where in the wild, because you say Maine, is that southern coastal Maine, or is that up on a really high mountain under the protection of a bunch of pines? Those right. are two very different things. And so I think there just needs to be more nuance to how we're even just like learning about species and being able to approach them. So that was my takeaway. It's given me a lot. I think it's the sign of a really good conference or workshop when you walk away with more questions than you have answers, because I think that means it really was challenging you to think in a way that you haven't thought before.
What are some questions that still are on your mind from it?
It's really forced me to think through my process. And a lot of times my starting point is how big it gets, which is important, and can it be sourced? And so it's a chicken and an egg type thing where I can't really be specking trees that are not grown in the trade. But I think there's a lot of good things out there that are not grown in the trade. And there's a variety of reasons to that. There's some things that are just hard to propagate. There's some things that don't do well being field grown. And there's some things that I think just designers aren't asking for. And so you need to have a market for the things that you're growing, and growing a tree is a multi-year endeavor for a grower. And so you need to be rest assured that you're going to get a return on that investment. And so there's just, I think this is a much wider conversation for designers to be having with installers, with landscape companies that are managing landscapes, and with nurserymen. And I think we, because I think nurseryman say, I'm not going to grow that tree because no one's ever asking for it, but we're not asking for it because it's nowhere to be found in any of the nursery catalog. And then there's certain trees that I think are just really hard to manage. Like I love a river birch, but it's dropping twigs everywhere. It's shaggy bark. So you have to be very thoughtful. You don't want to put that right near someone's front door. Also, the roots are going to buckle any sidewalks and things. So there's things like maintenance wise, where it's, river birch might be the absolute perfect successional plant to put in this spot. But there's other factors to consider with that would make someone's everyday life a major headache. So yeah, I think it could be tempting to throw the baby out with the bathwater and just say, we're only going to think from a successional lens. And I think it's more integrating a successional lens into the more functional questions that you also have to ask.
Yeah.
But I think there's some room for growth in the selection so that we don't just have the same trees everywhere because we know that they work and they're available. I think we need to push the boundary there a little bit.
Yeah, beautiful. So you got to meet Sarah Price.
I got to meet Sarah Price.
So she did the design for the outside area, Piazza. I don't know exactly what you specifically call it.
Piazza. Yes, the big one in Bergamo is called, they all have really cool names. This one's Piazza Vecchia.
Yeah, beautiful. What was meeting her, what was her garden like that she installed? And then you also mentioned that she did a presentation on that. So
yes.
Can you talk about some of the things that you learned from her?
Of course. Yeah. I think I said on my own podcast before the conference, I wonder if I'm going to get to meet her. I would just die. And then there's hundreds and hundreds of people at this conference. So I was like, we'll see. But I got a little gang of British garden designers I was hanging out with. And so a lot of them knew her. And I was grabbing a drink after one of the days with a bunch of friends. And they kept saying, let's save that seat for Sarah. And in my head, it didn't even register that it would be Sarah Price. And then lo and behold, Sarah Price appeared. I was like, that was the Sarah that we were saving a seat for. And I've just admired her work ever since I was in grad school. I was introduced to her work, I think like in an old garden design magazine. And looking at her renderings for her gardens, there was something about them where I was like, yes, some people really geek out on CAD drawings, and I think that's great. I just have a deep appreciation for people who appreciate that. It doesn't speak to my heart. And there was something about Sarah's drawings that really touched me because it felt like they communicated what a place felt like as well as what the design was. And that's so hard to do in a rendering. And then in 2023, I was able to go to the Chelsea Flower Show and saw her amazing garden. I think it won a gold medal, and it was where she had the irises and those beautiful walls. It was just so artful. Each color had been considered. It just made you feel something, even though you're like elbowing people to get to the front to see it. But just the way that light came through, and I was there right when the gates opened and in the first light of the day. So yeah, I'm just a huge fan of Sarah, and getting to meet her in person. They say never to meet your heroes, but I've only had one time where I was like, yes, that is very true. Every other time I've really found it not to be true. And Sarah was one because she just sat down and was just, you could just tell the gentleness and the compassion and the thoughtfulness that she brings to each design is just who she is as a person. And we were actually sitting in Piazza Vecchia, and she was facing out looking at her masterpiece in the piazza. And we were sitting there, all of a sudden she was like, that pot's gone on wonky. And she like walks up and starts adjusting one of the pots that had tipped over. But her design, I landed in Milan around 9 a.m. in the morning, took the first train to Bergamo and arrived there around lunchtime, I believe. And I immediately on cobblestones with my roller suitcase was bumping through the streets, and I was like beelining it to get to Sarah's design in the piazza. And it did not disappoint. It just felt, there were so many. At a macro level, it read as just this beautiful, natural, all knit together in such a beautiful way. And there are these huge painted canvases that emerged swooping from different corners of the piazza. Mm. And then the planting created these little nooks where you were forced into these little crevices and where the garden would rewrap around you. And then when you got closer, you would notice there were slight variations and drifts of different colors that all knit together, but you really couldn't pick up on those details until you got close because it was a lot of woolly grasses. And then you got closer and there'd be little salvias and catmints and coleostemon, a mist flower was popped in there, and just these dainty, beautiful, colorful drifts. But then there would be a nymphophia popping up right next to the orange painted canvas. And so there are these moments where you all of a sudden would turn and be like, I hadn't even seen that composition from that angle yet. So it was just really everything that I expected from a Sarah Price landscape, of just at the macro, larger level, it read so beautifully. And during all different times of days, the light came through the plaza from different angles, it changed. But then as you got closer, there were just more and more layers to uncover. She even had these beautiful logs that were framing the edges of the plantings, and they would have moss and lichen on them. You just felt like you were very aware that you were in a piazza. Like, it spoke to the context of the place, but it also felt you were in the woods of Italy. It was remarkable. And her inspiration, the talk that she gave, she walked through her design process, and she put up this one picture. It was this painting. There's an art museum in Bergamo that has these beautiful old medieval paintings, and it was all these people with these cloths wrapped around them, which was her inspiration for these beautiful canvases that were painted. But then she counted there was over 200 and something species of plants that were within this painting. And so there was so much layering and diversity. And so it was just remarkable to hear her talk through what struck her about this painting, and then how she translated that to the piazza planting. And even more remarkable is that I didn't know that the designer that's chosen each year for the piazza, which is a huge honor, but they're completely volunteer. So they're not paid to design it and wow. handle the installation. So I thought that was really spoke a lot.
Yeah, that is a labor of love.
Yes, absolutely.
Because yeah, I've seen them from previous years. That's a lot.
Yes, I know Nigel Dennett's done one. Luciano did one. So there's been some big names that have come through. But Sarah's was, honestly, that was the tipping point for me of deciding to go back to this conference, was that she was doing the piazza. I just thought, okay, I'm going to be heartsick if I'm seeing pictures posted of this and I didn't get to see it in person.
Yeah, yeah. Did she talk anything about like how she thinks about plant selection? Like, I think that's so brilliant to look at an inspiration of something that someone has made, like you were talking about with the painting, and to draw inspiration from that. I know if you read like Roy DeBlick's book, The No Maintenance Perennial Garden, he will do designs. He'll say, this is based off this painting, or this is based off this painting. But did she talk about anything about her plant selection? And I realized, too, that at some level, this is one of these show gardens. Like, mm-hmm. it is here today, gone tomorrow. And yeah. so what we would typically see in a garden is we would see like progression of seasons. Sometimes plants are grown and sourced so that they can be really sensational for that period of time. But I was just curious, does she talk any more about her thoughts on how she chose the plants, selected the plants, arranged the plants, anything else on her process?
Yeah, I wish I had recorded her talk, because I was just sitting there gobsmacked. And I think she did, but I think the plant selection came down to, she was working with a local nurseryman who's really involved with the festival. And it was, she visited his nursery and he knew it would be looking good that time of year. And so I think that really limited the palette. So she, which honestly as a designer is sometimes a blessing of just, yeah, that's true. I don't have the whole world at my disposal. The constraints can actually really work in your favor. And so I think it was basically his nursery was her plant selection. They did bring in these beautiful old olive trees that just were like hundreds and hundreds of years old. You could just tell from the branching and how huge the trunks were. So that gave the piazza just this feeling of age. But as far as the herbaceous layers, I think it was what they had at that nursery. But it was a lot of grasses and very dainty flowers. And then a lot of seed heads. So there were teasels tucked in there that had just their brown seed heads popping up. It felt just very ethereal. There wasn't a whole lot of coarse textures. It was very airy feeling. And then you had have these massive olive trees coming up. But she didn't really talk through that I'm remembering. I could have this totally wrong as someone who's there as Molly. Did you black out during that part of her talk? But it really was more about how she crafted the spatial qualities of the design, how it was inspired from that painting.
Beautiful. So Another presentation I know that you enjoyed was Tom Stuart Smith and Katie Merrington, where they presented together. Can you talk about that presentation, some of the things you learned?
Yes. Yeah, so this was one of the days that also sold me on going back, because it was about the relationship between a designer and the gardener that will be caring for that space. And how do you work together to create the best garden in the end? And Tom and Katie they just have the sweetest relationship. And Katie, I have known who she was from afar. She's friends with a lot of my British gardening friends. And it was an utter delight to just sit back and listen to her speak, because she's so effortlessly funny, but just brought up some really thought-provoking points as the gardener. And so Tom designed the Hepworth Wakefield Garden, and it's outside this garden museum in Wakefield in Yorkshire, which is a pretty industrial town. I don't think it's really a town that would be on most like tourist destination spots. It's just a pretty like middle-class working community. And then there's this incredible art museum that's very stark and concrete. And then there's this beautiful, just whimsical, layered, very Tom Stuart Smith garden adjacent to it, where it had just been lawn. And so Tom, I think when he came onto the project, he really pushed, we need to bring a gardener on now, as this garden is being designed and installed. And so they were able to bring Katie on while the garden was being installed. And I thought, you know, how it's so important, I think, for a gardener to be there, because they're just approaching it from a different posture, and are there on site every day. Whereas a designer, you kind of have to move on to the next projects. But a gardener can be there as an advocate, making sure that things are going in the ground correctly, that soil's being prepped correctly. And then Tom comes back every year to the museum, and he and Katie do a walk around, and they keep that dialogue going as things are, some things are really working, some things they've had to retweak. And you can tell Tom deeply values the input that Katie brings and what she brings to the table. But then Katie really leans on Tom and his eye for the design. But what really struck me was Tom, he said at one point, I don't want to be the author of something static, but I think he said the conductor of something in motion was were the words that he used. And he sees Katie as a part of that orchestra that is helping the whole flow of this thing that has been set in motion. And they were just very honest about difficulties that arise and things that you can't foresee, and just that it's a whole lot of work. And then I think what really rose to the top was just how gardeners are, the value that they're given within these projects is often not enough. And so a lot of times Tom even said at one point, I think as designers, we need to take less fee so that we can attract better talent and actually raise the status of the gardener, because what we design won't actually be what we've envisioned without the hands in the gardener and having knowledgeable, skillful, passionate people that are shepherding that vision throughout the years. And I think he realizes he's really lucky to have someone like Katie who cares deeply and is skilled and is always learning and sharpening herself. But it was also really moving hearing Katie speak about working in a public garden and just the conversations that she has with the public, because I think she began in the middle of COVID. And so they were allowed to be outside, I believe, like 1 or 2 hours a day for exercise. So a lot of people would come walking through the garden every day and they would see her there. And she said, there's something about being a gardener where you're stooped down and you're working, but someone can still stand and talk to you. She said, the things that people have told me, somehow it invites conversations to happen. And so she's, some days there's gardening tasks that I don't get to because I just felt like my job today is to listen to this person who doesn't maybe have anyone else to talk to. And I just love that was also a piece of the conversation. There's a very human aspect to these places within, especially public spaces, and the conversations that they invite and the role that they play in people's daily lives, I think is really moving. And it needs a gardener that's there tending it.
So James Hitchcock also presented as well. Can you talk about some of the things that he shared?
Yes, man, I love James. James is like a rock and roll horticulturist. He's so cool. And I actually had the opportunity to work with him in Sheffield with he and Nigel Dennett when I was a student in England for a year. And I just remember sitting in his lectures and thinking, I've never heard someone talk about horticulture this way. He just asked questions of like, why do you have to take your pruners and snip every little flower? Why can't you take a weed eater? And it's 30 seconds versus 3 hours. That's really important in the municipal planting. So can we design knowing that there's only this many hours of labor to give towards a space versus designing something that's really, it makes the job harder. So he just is very thoughtful in how we ask questions and then drawing conclusions that impact design. And so his whole talk was on understanding how plantings are managed and working backwards towards the design instead of allowing the, and I think it has to come from both directions because there's design ideas that will drive certain management solutions. But then I think if you know there's only certain management capabilities, that needs to really inform the design.
Yeah, that's true.
And one thing that I loved was that on his last slide, he said, I have it written down right here. He said, will management be seen as an important part of the design? Question mark. Who will train people that are going to be able to manage these types of landscapes? And so he was really talking about these naturalistic plantings that are really ecologically rich, layered, and dynamic. And then his last question was, who will pay these people? Question mark. And that was his last slide. I've worked for decades, and this is what I have seen has worked. And he had just remarkable case studies all over the world that he's been a part of. He had an army of PhD students at the University of Sheffield that were constantly testing certain things. But at the end of the day, there's still some questions and there's some gaps. And it can't fall on one person to answer all those questions. And what's amazing about this conference is that there's people from all over the world. I have friends that came from Croatia, Montenegro, Czech Republic, South America, all different parts of the US, Canada, all different parts of Europe. There was a man that spoke from India. And so it was just, we're each bringing completely different cultural lenses to the table and different management practices and different resources to the table. But the questions he posed were universal of, we need the people who are managing these landscapes to be a valued part of this process. But at the end of the day, they need to be trained and they need to be compensated for the skill set that they bring to the table. And we've got to ask those questions and find solutions to that in whatever part of the world we're working in. And one person that I felt like his talk began to touch and is a really interesting study in being a solution to all these questions is John, I'm blanking on his last name, but he's in, I believe he lives in Sydney, Australia. He's a landscape architect and is working on a massive park in Melbourne that it's going to be a multi-year endeavor. Millions and millions of dollars are going into it. And they have formed a team, which includes Nigel and James. He's the designer. They brought in a lady named Jack, who also lives in Melbourne. She has Bloom is her studio, and she has an amazing Super Bloom. She has an amazing book. And so she's just really steeped in local horticultural knowledge for Melbourne. And so they formed this whole team where they have a design, but then they've created these plant trials where they're trialing the species, not only for which species will work best in combination with each other, but they also have a public-facing trial where they're recording public perception of these different plant combinations through the year. I think it's already been going for a couple of years, and they're working with a university who's running some of these trials and testing all kinds of things from like ecological services like pollinators or how different things perform to different maintenance regimens. Just really exciting things that will deeply impact the design, and they're allowing those findings to impact the design choices that are made. And they've already brought on the director of horticulture for the park, even though the park hasn't gone in the ground yet. They've already brought him in so that he can be a major part of these conversations. But it's a lot of monetary investment that the city of Melbourne is giving to this place. But I think just it was so exciting hearing someone speak from a design perspective, but also talk about all the different people from different facets of the industry that have been brought together to make this successful. And how much they are valuing that input on all fronts of the process of the design. And so that really felt like one, a project where the process, it's not seen as a final product. It's seen as a process that you're setting in motion. And even the design process is allowed to be a process and engaged with and inform. And I think a lot of times, if you're not a designer, I think a lot of times clients think that I can show up on site and they'll tell me all the problems and it goes in one ear and out the other ear comes the solution. And as design just doesn't work that way. But I see how it can feel that way when it's just not your, it's not your frame of knowledge. You're like, oh, you know how this works. Bada bing, there you have it. And I even have a meeting with a client this afternoon where they're wanting some layered naturalistic plantings, beautiful 17-acre site overlooking one of our state parks, just a really special place. And I've finished the design, but it's not in any way like CAD exact quantities and things. There were just things where I thought, I've got to get a contractor on board and begin to have these conversations. And they were wanting me to get a quote from two different contractors to compare numbers. I felt really strongly it needed to be this one certain contractor. And so I basically called the clients and said, hey, it makes total sense to me that you're wanting to compare prices. I think that financially that makes a lot of sense. However, let me talk you through what this one contractor is going to bring to the table that is goes well beyond just a number. And once I explained it to the client, I was just like, he's going to be our partner. He has relationships with nurserymen. I brought him to the site. We were out there for 2 hours. He already was reeling off ideas. I just really feel like he's going to be a partner in this process and take it to a level, whereas another landscaper is going to be looking at me and just want exact circles drawn on a piece of paper and they want to get in and get out. And I feel like this contractor really loves your site and it's going to partner with us. And they were like, great, let's do it. So I think sometimes it just takes giving the clients looking to you to guide that process and champion their best interest. And I think I've already felt how Bergamo is empowering me in my own work to make some of those moves in my own work.
Well, that's cool. And I think the guy was John Hazelwood. I was trying to find Hazelwood. His name.
Yes.
Yeah, because I screenshot a photo that Annie took. I screenshot stuff all the time.
Yes, same.
Find it. But I love there was a slide that he did where it was like this grid of a whole bunch of different species together on it, just a little graphic representation there. But I think that trialing and evaluating on site is so critical, because if I could go back in time and redo anything here at Ephemera Farm, I would probably just buy as much as I could the first year and then just put it all in the ground and see what lived and what didn't. Because that's something that, now living here 8 years, I have a pretty good library in my head of what's going to thrive. But I know Dan Pearson, he does that as well too, because I think they've done trials over in like Japan of where they're going to do a new garden. And I think Pete Adolf just growing stuff at the nursery. That is so important to have an idea of the plant language you're going to use to write with on a site.
Absolutely.
And I think that's really important.
And Tom Stewart Smith literally has the plant library.
Yeah.
And that's the ultimate dream my studio is actually in my parents' backyard. It's like our little playhouse that my dad built for us when we were kids, but it's now my studio. And I live in a little condo. And so I use their garden as my trialing grounds. And it's been really fun to see my dad and my mom get really excited about things. But we did that. I just ordered in a ton of flats and planted things out. And I was like, okay, so that didn't work, but this really did work. And so there is a freedom in that, but it can be hard when a client has hired you for an end product to allow the experimentation to take place in the process. But there was another speaker, Mariana. She came all the way from Brazil, and I had tears in my eyes during her talk because she just really took us on her own, on a journey with her. And she trained as an architect. And I asked her afterwards, I actually stopped her in the street and was, my friend and I were just wanting to let her know how much her talk really moved us. And I said, you trained as a landscape or as an architect. I have a lot of friends from grad school that also trained as architects and then found their way to landscape architecture. And she said, yeah, there's really nowhere to train even as a horticulturist in Brazil. Your agronomy is the closest you can get to it. And so she came to landscape design from the avenue of architecture, but had this client who asked her for a biome garden. She was like, what's a biome garden? She started researching it. She was like, okay, great. So you just need to basically know the native landscape and create that. So then she goes to the nursery and she starts asking for all these native species. And they say, what are you talking about? And she was realized all these beautiful native grassland species weren't available in the trade. And so then that sent her out into the wild, and she began collecting seeds, and she had these mentors that helped her learn how to go out and find plants and grow them on, and she partnered with nurseries. But she went back to this client that had asked for this when she realized it was going to be more of an undertaking than she had initially realized, and said, explained it to her, like, if we're wanting to create a grassland here, I'm going to need to do A, B, and C. And the client said, how long do you need? And she said, I think I need 5 years. And the client said, I'll give you 10. And so she had a client that bought in and understood and valued the process it was going to take. And now she's brought to the forefront this forgotten piece of the Brazilian landscape. It's called the Cerrado, but it's one of their native grasslands. And because you think Brazil and you think rainforest, but there's so many other different types of native landscapes within Brazil. It's a massive country. And I just thought that was so moving, because a lot of times in Alabama, it can feel like the way that I was trained in my horticultural degree, it set me up so well to enter the landscaping industry, the status quo, how things have been done. And as I've gone further afield, I've been challenged to think differently, but it can feel really intimidating of, oh, but that's not how things are done here. So can I actually do it? It can feel really daunting. And then there's these landscapes I want to design and get my hands dirty with and trial, but clients are looking to me saying, okay, have you done that before? Who's going to help me maintain this? How much will that cost? Where are you going to get these? They're starting to ask me these questions where I think, I don't know. There's some question marks there. And that can just feel daunting. I think I got back from Bergamo. You can listen on the podcast, episode 6. Tessa and I both have existential crises and record it. So for your listening pleasure, but there could just be these moments where you think, what in the world am I doing? Is this possible? Am I barking up the wrong tree? But then just coming back down, I think you need to go through those mental exercises. Sometimes I come back and I think, no, I think it's an endeavor worth taking. Not every client is going to be a client where I can push those boundaries, but it's up to me to kind of sense when I have someone who's willing to push the boundaries and go for it and push the needle a little bit more. And then I think I also walked away realizing it's okay to ask for help. And I run a studio. It's just me. But I have a wide network here in the Southeast, and garden people are just the best people in the entire world. They are so forthcoming there's not a whole lot of gatekeeping. There's just, everyone is so willing to share their knowledge, and a rising tide raises all ships is a mentality that I feel like governs the garden world. And it's okay to ask for help and bring other viewpoints into play. And I don't think that's detracting at all from your role as a designer, but I think it's actually really wise in a lot of cases.
Yeah. Apiary Studio was there at the conference as well. Yeah. Can you talk about what you learned from them?
Oh, my word. I could have just sat and listened to them all day. So they are headed up by Hans and Martha. And I believe Hans is trained as a landscape architect. And then Martha, I believe, did the Longwood professional gardening program. And so they just come from this place of deep design knowledge. And you can just tell that they have such a beautiful way of crafting spaces. But then Martha brings this deep knowledge of plant and planting design. And then they run their own crews, which I think I was sitting there thinking, oh no, is the solution to all my questions in my head that I need to start running my own crews, which feels very daunting, but exciting, but scary. So I'm still mulling over that. But their studio, their niche that they have found is reusing materials. And so he had all these crazy stories of seeing just random concrete that was piled up on the side of the road and going up and asking the contractor, are you hauling this off? Do you mind if I take it? Or showing up to a client's house and finding reusable materials on site, but they do it in such an artful way. And it's just a different lens of looking at sustainability as how can we, it tells a story of the site in a really beautiful way, but you're also not paying to haul off all this material and bring in other material. And so it's deeply sustainable. And then just it makes each place incredibly unique. And so they walked through several projects and are definitely a studio just to keep watching, because each of their projects had such a feeling of being of that place. And I found it really inspiring because I love the planting bits of projects, and sometimes the hardscaping bits can feel really intimidating. And I think it just reawakened a interest in me in those bits of, okay, we can find nuances, and even these parts of a design can really tell a story and be a huge asset to the design and not just a functional bit. I need to hold up this grade and I need a retaining wall here, but they can actually bring something to the table that wasn't there before. So I just loved, and I got to meet them and spoke to them for a while at one of the dinners, one of the nights. It was really fun having fellow East Coast Americans there too.
Beautiful. Are there any other designers that you really enjoyed listening to? I know all of them, but are there any other standouts that you want to share on the podcast?
Yes, I think the same day that Tom and Katie spoke, they spoke in the morning, and then the afternoon was a duo. Fernando is the designer, and they're in Spain. And then Carlos was his contractor that helps with all the installs and the management of his gardens. And his gardens, Fernando was just talking so nonchalantly, and he's clicking through all these pictures of his gardens. And I was just sitting there thinking, this man is incredibly talented. And then the questions, and then Carlos got up and he did a whole talk on what it takes to manage these types of gardens. And the questions that we should be asking in these types of landscapes. And so that was one where I filled pages and pages of notes, just thinking it. And it felt like Spain, a lot of the places where they're working, there's the same posture in the landscaping industry that I encounter in the southeastern U.S., where there's landscape crews that are mobile go, and in a lot of these naturalistic plantings, it really depends on having not very fertile soil, because that favors more of our native species. And the two of them just kept laughing about these contractors that they can't get to stop fertilizing the plants. No. So they're like, we think they come in the cover of night and have granular fertilizer in their pockets and are throwing it out. they're like, the number of times we've gone through it. So it's just, there's, everyone has their battles that they're fighting in their parts of the world. And it was just incredibly refreshing to see the inspiring work that's coming out despite some of the constraints that your current context might be giving you. And I think going to these conferences, especially working alone, it can feel really hard to get out of town and to leave your work behind for a week. And every time I kind of question as I'm leading up to it, was this a good use of my time and my resources? And then every time I'm there, I think, oh, my heart and my soul needed this. There's just a sense of camaraderie. We're not all doing this alone. There's other people out there doing incredible work. And I just am so grateful I had the opportunity to meet them and learn from them. And I can't stress enough how important it is to get out of the silo of your own region and your own, even for me, it's just the silo of my own head and just be sharpened by other people.
Yeah. Great. Anything else from the conference? Besides tiramisu.
I was about to say, there was the Tour de Tiramisu, which I think my phone has heard me talking and it has started targeting me for the World Championship Tiramisu Games that are held in Italy in October. So I thought,
that's hilarious.
I feel like maybe should I just extend my trip next year and stay for the World Championship.
Exactly.
They're always asking for judges. So you have to apply and then you can get chosen as a judge. So. Yeah. Stay tuned. That might be my journey next year.
For me, it would have been the Tour de Gelato. So,
oh, yeah, that was involved as well.
So a couple questions wrapping up that I had. So you were recently involved on a really cool project in Charleston, where, of course, you did the design of it. And I'll let you share anything you want on that. But having been to Bergamo, mm-hmm. Is there anything you would change about that project, ideas you came back with? Is there anything you would do differently? And I'm not saying you did do a great job. I'm just saying that sometimes after you go and things, and hear different perspectives, it can change your attitude. And I'm sure like some of the things we've already talked about, like the successional progression of trees mm-hmm. might, but anything you would change about that project?
Yeah, I actually really love that question because I think it assumes there's always going to be things as a designer that you would look back and do differently. And that's okay. And that I was actually speaking with a lady and I had a friend next to me who's also a designer. She's an interior designer. And she was just saying, what a fun that y'all both found yourself in creative fields. What a just like a lovely life to lead. And I don't know where this came from inside of me. For some reason, I said, yeah, it is lovely, but it's also a tortured lifestyle because you're just always thinking it's really hard to turn it off.
And yeah, it is.
With Charleston, tortured probably isn't the word, but you just agonize over, as a designer, you're a decision maker. And so there's just so many things to think about. And then I like to be very confident in the decision that I have made. But in Charleston, I think looking at that one, this was a really fun project, but it was one in which I felt my gut. I'm scared, but it's the good kind of scared. And I was so excited to be given this opportunity. So the Charleston Parks Conservancy hired me back in December. And I was tasked with redesigning Colonial Lake Park, which had gone through a multi-million dollar redesign back in 2016, where the entire infrastructure was redesigned. But in 2016 and 17, Charleston was hit with major hurricanes where this park was under salt water for days at a time, like 3 to 5 feet of salt water. It wasn't just like inches. And it basically wiped out most of the plantings. And so my job was to come and to redesign the plantings in a way where I was taking into consideration the management resources of the conservancy, because they have a team of horticulturists, but they also have 26 parks that they're partnering with the city of Charleston to maintain. So they don't really just have like a team that's dedicated to this one park. So I needed to know that there's limited resources. We need to design in a way where it's layered and beautiful and interesting, but manageable. And so there was so many conversations about that. And looking back, we just went for the opening of the park, or it stayed open the whole time, but it was really a celebration of the renovation of the park. And it culminated with this all-day event on Saturday where I had the opportunity to give a talk about my design process. And I really encourage designers, when you get to the end of a project, you might not be like me, but I got to the end of the project and I thought, what even was my process? Because you're just taking these micro steps each step along the way, and you get to the end and it's felt just such an inevitable product that you almost feel as if maybe you didn't have a process, but you do. And so I had to put together this presentation. I was going back, oh my word, yes, I did do that. And so one thing I don't regret doing is I made a whole Google Sheet form and I had tabs for each type of planting. So I had trees, hedges, sunny shrubs, sunny perennials, shady shrubs, shady perennials, ground covers. And I made this master list with all these different components of what we should consider about that plant. And then I left a notes column, shared it with the whole horticultural team, and they were able to bring their wealth of knowledge to the table. We had several different Zoom calls where we talked through the different planting palettes. And so I felt like we had everything as considered as we could moving into the installation. But one thing I would change is I wish that in my initial proposal, I had included more trips for installation during that process. And because I went to the site in January, I had concept done by mid-February, final drawings by mid to late March. I was there for install first week of April. So it was rolling fast because we were racing the heat in Charleston to get stuff in the ground. But you inevitably run into sourcing hiccups. You can't find certain things. Things are delayed. There are a whole host of things that can cause snags. And so when I came for install, we were really laying out shrubs, which was great. But I wish I had another visit in there to come back and lay out the herbaceous things and then another one to come back. Because as summer progressed, we saw certain things were working and some things weren't. And the hort team did a great job of texting me pictures, or they would FaceTime me. But there's just something about being there and actually having the pots in your hands and being able to lay it out and tweak it that I think is just innately how I work as a designer. I need to touch and feel, and it's a kind of a gut instinct. And like my 16-page CAD drawing said, it had the framework in place. I believed in it, but there's just certain things that need to tweak on site. Yeah. So
field adjustments.
Field adjustments. I think I would probably
PDOT called it in the movie and the documentary.
That's a beautiful term for it. Yeah, that sounds much more official than just, I'm going to kick this pot here, pull this one here. But I do think that's allowing the design to be more of a process and not be married to the piece of paper. And
yeah.
I just think that makes for a better product. But all in all, it was such a fun project. And I think sitting through Bergamot made me realize how lucky I was. This is my first time doing the scale of a public project. And then having the conservancy that has such knowledgeable horticulturists who were bought in, that believed in the vision of the design. And I didn't realize how I'm innately someone who's going to include lots of different people through the process. I don't want to be, like Tom said, the author of a product. I knew it was going to be really important that they were bought in and included in the process. And so it got to the end and it just felt like they understood the decisions and were able. And the horticulturist, he told me that the one that's managing the whole project, he said, I just love that your design, I feel like I understand it and I hope you don't mind, but there were some things that I shifted different places. And I said, Rob, that's like the biggest compliment you could have ever given me, is that you feel empowered to make decisions as the gardener. That at the end of the day, I've done my job if you're able to make those adjustments within the framework that I've set in place. Yeah, I just feel really lucky to be a part of that. It was just the most fun process and such a fun team to work with. And I hope there's more projects like that in the future, because it really sharpened me in a lot of ways. It was a lot of mental labor that when I finished, I grew up a swimmer. My dad used to tell me, I want you to leave it all in the pool. I want to have to come pull you out of the pool at the end of your race. And this felt like one of those designs where I felt like I had to get pulled out of the pool at the end, but in the best of ways. Like you just left it all there.
Yeah.
So it was great.
Yeah. Do you think it's possible for us to create something here like Bergamot? Because I was talking to, I think it was Brent and Lisa up at Intrinsic a few weeks ago about just how wonderful, I think it was going on, their grass day was going on around the same time as Bergamot. And
yes,
we were talking about how we think probably the Woody and Perennial Conference that's hosted at Swarthmore, and of course multiple other groups are involved in hosting that. But you think it's possible for us to have something like Bergamot here?
And maybe even
I'm saying here, I guess thinking about the United States, but maybe even the Southeast.
When you said here, my mind immediately went to the Southeast, because it is such an untapped kingdom, I feel like, in a lot of these conversations. And I'm sure you feel this way sometimes, but like when I go to the Perennial Plant Association or even Bergamot, I met a man from New York and then a couple from Canada, and they both were like, so you're from Alabama? How did you even hear about Bergamot? I think I could tell their wheels were turning. Like, what are you doing here? And I just feel like I love it when people say that, because I get to tell them all about Alabama and what an amazing place it is and how we're the fourth most biodiverse state and just all that we have to offer. But I think the Southeast, there are people that are so passionate and are so knowledgeable, but a lot of times they're in a back county road and they're just growing pitcher plants because they're fascinated by them and they don't need anyone to know that they're doing it. There's just so many passionate people and knowledgeable people because they've done it for decades. Mm. And a lot of times I go to other conferences in the Southeast, there just aren't many people there that are a part of these wider conversations. And so I think it could be, and gardening is something where it is incredibly regional. And so I go to these conferences where they're talking about certain species, or even Henrik's book, a lot of the species that are in the back of the book, I'm having to look up the American counterparts to a lot of the European species. And I just wish that there could be a meeting of the minds. I think that would be really powerful and an amazing catalyst to send people back out into their part of the Southeast. And even doing this project in Charleston is wildly different than Birmingham. And while they're zone 8B, 9A, I'm 8A. So you would think in hardiness zone language, I'm not that different. Could not be more different in the plantings that we have to use, because the heat and the humidity and the salt, there's just so many more factors that completely change the game if you're in a coastal southern state. So I think it would be incredible. So I think, yes, let's do it, Jared.
Let's do it. Thanks for sharing those thoughts, because that's one of my focuses, trying to figure out how do we garden more ecologically here in the South. And I think part of it, too, is educating the people that it's not just all camellias and hollies and daylilies.
Yes.
That there is.
And you're on the forefront of that. You have students and you're getting them out into the garden and teaching them about, I think that's a huge piece that's missing from a lot of horticultural education is actually getting your hands dirty.
Oh, yeah.
And sure. There's just a lot that can't be learned.
But I think we also have to change the expectations of our clients. And yeah, sure, now some people are starting to ask for it. They're saying like, I want a pollinator garden or something like that. Mm-hmm. I'm leading into this question because one of the things that I wrote down from listening to your podcast is that part of the process of design and gardening is how to observe, strategize, and respond to the landscape. Mm-hmm. And what I've heard throughout this whole conversation today is, I think something that you've been thinking about is that design is a process.
Yes.
And it's not just a final product. If you remodel, the kitchen's done. But if you overhaul your landscape, it's not done. One of the things I've struggled with this year is I have holes because I've lost narrow leaf mountain mint for whatever reason. It started dying out. I don't know if it's voles or soil acidity. I'm trying to investigate that. I've done some soil tests. So we're going to try to figure that out. But you're right. It is a process to try to figure out how things change. And I was just curious, sure, after this conference, you've still been marinating past that 9-hour flight back. But are there any other ideas that you're really still marinating over besides landscaping as a process instead of a product?
I have, because there's a facet of my studio where I get asked a lot to come out and just do quick consults at people's yards. And I've been told by lots of people in business, Molly, that's not what you do. You're driving yourself crazy. You're not really going to make any money doing that. There's a piece of me that can't let it go because I see this spark of interest from people, but they can't pay for my full design services. It might be people my age just bought their first house. They know it's not their forever home. They're not going to do a $50,000, $75,000 landscape installation, but they care. And I am just not willing. I can't figure out a way of how do I capture that spark that I'm sensing in them and foster it in a way that is sustainable for them. And so that when Tessa and I started the podcast, she's in Greenville, South Carolina. We both were coming at this of, is there a way that we could capture people's attention without us having to drive all over town and kill ourselves doing these 1-hour consults? And so that's been one forefront that's been just a really fun creative outlet. But then the other thing that's been toying my mind actually came from Katie Merrington when we were grabbing a drink on the piazza after one of the days. And we were talking about this. And I just said, Katie, we need more Katies. I would kill to just be able to clone you and have you in Birmingham. And I was like, I've just been thinking like, we need like a school or something that's training people with these types of skills. And she said, there you have it, Molly. No, I think you should start a school. And I thought, there's so many people who find out what I do and they think, man, I wish I had known about that. That sounds so fun.
Oh, yeah.
There may be an accountant stuck behind Excel all day or just doing something that pays the bills but doesn't bring much joy to their life. And I thought, or there's people that are retired or empty nester moms who all of a sudden have more time on their hands and, you know, are interested. I thought, what if I could have workshops that people come to? I think it just has planted a seed of, what if instead of me coming to your house for an hour and giving you some quick how-to step-by-step problem-solving things, which is, I honestly isn't getting at the deeper root of the issue. What if I had, and it might be my parents' garden, but what if there was a place where people could come and I could invite them into this process and they could get their hands dirty and they could learn and it would be a place where they could come and that spark of curiosity could be grown in a way where they could then be empowered. My dream would be that they would then be empowered to go back to their own gardens and make decisions, a lot like Rob, the gardener at Colonial Lake, when he was telling me, like, I really feel like I'm able to like make decisions and tweak things and adjust. And I thought, yes, some designers might freak out at that, but that to me is like the most beautiful thing I could have heard. And I think that would be the dream. Rather than, I just don't think that I want to be running my own crews. I like the flexibility of being just a one-woman show and I contract out certain pieces that I need to throughout my process. But it might be okay that I can't get to everyone's house, but what if there was a way that I could incubate that little, that spark of curiosity? So stay tuned. We'll see. Still marinating.
Awesome. So second to last question I always ask on every podcast is how can we propagate the love of horticulture and increase the number of gardeners? And of course, on the first podcast, you said engaging with children. Do you have any other thoughts now that you've been to Bergamo and have a little bit more experience under your belt since we last talked?
Yes. And I do think capturing kids' hearts and imaginations for wild places is key. But then I think just continuing to, and it's been really encouraging, the comments Tessa and I have gotten on the Garden Gap podcast a lot of times has been, wow, I just bought a home like this. I've always felt so intimidated. Y'all talking about it makes me see that I think freeing people up to make mistakes and learn from them, fail fast and fail often and learn from it. That's like the best way to learn is to try it. And as long as you have learned something from it, it's not for nothing. And I think sometimes people just need to be given license to try. And Tessa, she tells her story from just planting a tree and then seeing it grow. And then it made her curious about another. And it just was this tiptoeing into it. And then before she knows it, she's making a career change. And for me, it was growing up and playing in the woods with my sisters and just loving every second of being outside. And I think even letting people know that it's a viable career.
Yeah.
And that there's way more, it is a career in which you can make a very comfortable living, but it's also one in which I think it's such a gift to wake up and be really excited about what you're going to do every day and just to be around the best people in the whole world. And I think that's why I've leaned harder into the gardening world is because every time I was going to those conferences around garden people, I just thought, yes, these are my people. Where when I went to other more maybe just like design focused conferences, it wasn't the same. I didn't get the same heart palpitations that I get at garden people. And but I think also like propagating more knowledge, I think just comes with start small. Like maybe it's just getting a container. And I think it's freeing people up. I think a lot of people think that they have to be Martha Stewart out there like, doing the most at your three country houses. But you'll be shocked at how much joy just a container by your front door can give you. And a lot of my friends have young children. They're in that exhausted, I'm sure you know what this feels like, Jared. If you just see, keeping your head above, you have a little one with a lot of needs and maybe your garden isn't like the number one thing, you know, right now, but just doing a little something and building from there, I think.
Molly, there are so many weeds. There's so many weeds.
But your daughter's alive.
My daughter's alive and thriving. But I'm also, one of the things that's been so interesting about just a side discussion here on kids, one of the things that's been so interesting is seeing how the landscape has responded to less effort and less of me being out there. And so I've realized that some areas need some more attention. And the other thing, too, that I've learned is, to me, one of the limiting issues that I think we have here in the Southeast is that ground coverage is critical. Yeah, I think even more critical than up north because we have 12 months of growing down here.
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, is it's very difficult to find native low-growing species that are going to be able to cover the ground 12 months out of the year.
Yep.
That ground cover layer, it's been a challenge to try to find that. And fortunately, I'm now rethinking some of that and starting to go a little bit more of the James Golden approach of just let the competitors go almost.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones that can grow and cover the ground, but still have these spaces for these little more niche plants there. But yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. Connecting kids with plants, because the other joy too is that there's a muddy puddle out in the garden and the magnolias to go and stomp around in it.
Yes. And my niece she lives out in Texas. She just turned 5 and I sent her flowers for her birthday.
Oh, nice.
Just because my sisters, we don't need more things. And so I was like, what is a thing, but it will pass away. So you will. But my niece loves flowers. And I was on FaceTime with my sister the other night and the flowers had been tossed, but my niece had hoarded some and hid them under her pillow. And my sister was like, what a little pack rat is she doing? And I thought that has absolutely made my entire life that she loves those flowers so much. She was hiding them under her pillow.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah. Last question, of course, is where can people find out more about you? And then, of course, hey, let's give a shout out to Garden Gab.
Oh, you're the best, Jared. Yes, you can find out more. My studio is called Roots and Ramblings. So you can find me at rootsandramblings.com. And then I'm on Instagram, mainly is my social media outlet at Malls Hendry. And it's M-O-L-L-S, Hendry. And I'm about to revamp the Roots and Ramblings Instagrams. But if you're tuned in to Malls Hendry, you will get that fed to you as well. And then, yeah, the Garden Gab podcast, we are having the best time. It's me and my friend Tessa Penner, and we formatted it like a garden club, but for your ears. And we just chit chat to each other about what we've been out and about doing in our own practices and what we've been doing in our own gardens. And then we have random different committees that we will call. So wildlife committee, we'll chat all things, what's inspiring us. Or one of my favorite segments is door prizes, which we just talked about things we bought ourselves. It's been really fun. So I'd love to have you join the Garden Gab Club over on wherever you listen to your podcast.
Yeah, great. Cool. And it is a treat to listen to. So yeah, definitely check that
out. Thank you, Jared.
And thank you so much, Molly, for your time today and for letting me vicariously live your experiences with bergamot. I really appreciate your time.
Of course. Thank you for having me on. And next time, I just think that you need to come with and we'll experience it in real time together.
I love that idea. That sounds great. Yeah. And then, of course, I look forward to seeing you in South Carolina in February.
In February.
Yeah, we're going to speaking there together. So, yeah. So until then.
All right. Thanks, Jared.
Thanks, Molly. Bye.
Thanks so much for listening today. Do you have questions or comments? You can visit theplantasticpodcast.com for show notes and to reach out and say hi. Remember, plants can't talk, but we can. The plant world needs people to share how wonderful these green organisms are. So tell someone a fun fact about plants. Make it simple, make it remarkable, and most of all, make it plantastic. Until next time, keep growing.